Okay, folks, thanks. It's been good to talk at the coffee break. What have we been doing so far? We've been introducing this whole area of reaching out to others with the unbelievable good news of Christ. We said a little bit about some of the biblical mandates for that, some of the encouragements that we have in Scripture that Jesus is Lord and is with us while we do this. And then we've spoken about attentive listening, or listening carefully in this missional situation in which we find ourselves, and listening to the world's fears and hopes and drivers and so on and so forth. Let's move on. Well, I'd like to finish this, say a little bit about purposeful dialogue. I need to say up front, I've gone a lot slower than I thought I would with my material, and therefore there's every likelihood that we won't get through all that I've prepared. That being the case, I will do a little bit of cutting and pasting on my feet. If I don't say something that you were really hoping that we would get to, do please feel free to buttonhole me afterwards and talk to me, ask me a question. I'm very happy to do that. But I will kind of choose what we look at and so on. We'll see how we go anyway. Say a little bit about purposeful dialogue. It's only really as we engage in this attentive listening, as I've called it, that we can then engage in purposeful dialogue. And now you know that's true in life, and that's why it was great that somebody ended with talking about my wife doesn't think I listen. Maybe we're not brilliant listeners, actually. Maybe, I know I'm on record, I'm going to go on record as saying this, maybe the women actually whinge a bit too much about that. but maybe actually there is an art to listening that is really important when we're engaging with someone, so that we're not foisting ourselves on them, we're listening, hearing them first, and therefore responding appropriately in a way then that sets up a dialogue and doesn't miss an opportunity because we've been too quick to kind of seal the deal, as it were. So I think that's really at the heart of what I'm thinking of here when I talk about purposeful dialogue. But there are a number of tactics, I think, that we can use here, and some of them have been discussed in the literature. One important tactic is in engaging with others is to learn to ask good questions. What I've called there on the handout, querying questions. There are some helpful books on the handout if this is something that you would like to bone up on. There's a book by Gregory Kukul on the handout called Tactics. He's very helpful on this. And some books by Randy Newman as well on the handout. He also is very helpful on this. And Kukul writes about the Columbo tactic. You know the Detective Columbo? Played by Peter Falk. Most often found in this scruffy raincoat. And if you know the TV series, it wasn't so much a whodunit, because they always started out with the murder. And the rest of the programme was then about how Columbo would work it out. And a lot of that programme was about his interaction with the murderer in this case, and how he would question them and talk with them. And you know, he would come across as like a bumbling idiot. He'd be patting his pockets for his notebook and always looking for his pencil that he'd misplaced and so on. But you'd think that he'd miss the opportunity, but he'd be walking away and just to be going out the door, and he would say one more thing. Yeah, if you've seen the series, you'll know what I'm talking about. And he'd ask that question that would then just kind of just unravel the person just a little bit more. And that's what Greg Kukul talks about, you know, just how helpful questions can be when we're dialoguing with other people. And we often think that actually it's people who are asking us questions and we're having to be kind of dispensing answers, but actually we can do that the other way around too. We can ask questions of people in our dialogue with them. Jesus was a great question asker. I wish we had time to look at this in more detail. But have you noticed just how often he answered a question with a question? Asking questions makes people think. It opens up their cultural assumptions. It exposes faulty logic that some might have. Jesus was doing this all the time. It allows them to see other ways of looking at things that maybe they'd not thought of before. So there are gathering information type questions, and here of course you can be a 3-year old sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes it's the why question. You know, why? I mean, not to be irritating, but genuinely just to kind of push back. I wonder why do you say that? What do you mean by that? Just to kind of push back to keep the dialogue going. And then of course there are questions that reverse the burden of proof. Sometimes as Christians we think the burden of proof is on us to prove something, but we can ask questions that reverse that. How do you come to that conclusion? I'm curious, why does that idea seem so compelling to you? Or, you know, there are kind of softening questions that allow you to take the dialogue further. I wonder, have you ever considered thinking about it this way? Or, can you clear this up for me? I've heard you say, da da da, did you really mean that? The apologist Michael Ramsden, who is brilliant and talks all over the world on apologetics and university campuses and so on. But he says this about questions. He says, imagine you're in a cafe and someone says to you, I want to ask you a question. Do you think abortion is wrong? And the whole cafe goes quiet. And everyone's waiting for your answer as a Christian. Do you think abortion is wrong? So you are God's ambassador. You're about to speak on behalf of the King of Kings and the entire cafe is listening. What do you say? And if you say, yes, I think it's wrong, then you strongly suspect that the whole cafe will think, well, typical, judgmental, intolerant, closed-minded, bigoted, self-righteous Christian. Because in the eyes of society, what is abortion about? It's about choice. And if you say it's wrong, well, you're denying people's choice, free choice, to do what they want with their lives. And what do we call people who take away other people's choices? Well, we call them tyrants, dictators. That's what you are. Instead, Michael Ramsden says, how about reframing the question? Why don't you come back with a question like, when is it right to take an innocent person's life? Now that puts the issue on a different footing, you see. So you're reframing the issue, because they're asking a question about choice, essentially, and you're asking a question about the nature of human life. And that takes things to a different level altogether. Someone might say, so I suppose you think that all those sincere adherents of other religions are going to hell. And you might respond, that's interesting, do you believe in hell? Or, if there is a God and if there is a hell, why might he send someone there? How do you imagine he decides? Questions that move the conversation maybe up to a different level. Someone asks you about the problem of evil, and you might, not necessarily straight away, but you, no reason for you not to say, I'm curious to know what's your explanation for the problem of evil. See, just pushing back with questions of our own. The issue of same-sex relationships is of course, as has already been mentioned, enormous at the moment. And again, very sensitive area. But when I've been asked about it recently, I've started asking a question back, which goes something like this. Are there any sexual relationships that you wouldn't forbid? And for most people, even very liberal people, the answer is, there are. They would forbid some things. Unless they're out and out relativists. And so that then allows me to say something like, well, we share that in common then, because we both want to put a line in the sand somewhere. Yeah? We both agree, we're both bigots we both agree that there's a line in the sand somewhere. We just disagree about where that line is and what basis we draw it. So let's talk about that. And that moves the conversation to a different level, you see. So when we're faced with these questions, it's worth thinking about, you know, how could we ask a question back? So let me offer you this as a possible way of thinking through this area with respect to some of the standard questions. You might take a standard question like, why would a good God allow suffering? Now, of course, a question like that comes in all sorts of different guises, but often essentially that's what it boils down to. Now, a good first question to ask yourself, I think, is why you're engaging with someone. Someone says a variation on this question, and you're thinking quite quickly, why might someone ask this question? Why someone asks a question is really important. The person who, one of our friends, just in the last couple of weeks, literally, their 15-year-old toddler died with meningitis. So a question from that person, why does God allow suffering to happen? It's very different from the student who's chewing gum and saying, so what's the suffering in the world then? Very different question. Might be worded exactly the same, which you can understand is coming from a totally different place. So I think it's good for us to say, when we're faced with a question, we ask ourselves, why is this person asking this question? Because the same question can be asked for different reasons. And that makes it a different question, you see. The same question asked from a different motive is a different question, even if it's worded exactly the same way. Why might someone ask this question? Why might someone ask this question? Give me an answer. Sorry?
Tsunami.
Okay, so they might see something like tsunami, Boxing Day, years ago. Yeah, okay. Well, why else?
Through childhood suffering themselves.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, they've been experienced suffering themselves. Other things?
A quick way of closing down the conversation.
Okay, sometimes it's a way of saying, I don't really want to talk to you, I'm going to ask you what I think is a defeater, so you'll buzz off and leave me alone.
Yeah,
exactly, yeah. Different motives, yeah.
It can be sort of an old chestnut to avoid them from being probed, or to try and avoid them from being probed on other areas.
Okay, great. Okay, but I think it's in principle, if we can do it, and you have to be quite quick, of course. But particularly if you know a person, you might know something about why is this particular question being asked. It might be a different question. That's not the issue at stake. The issue is learn the kind of the tactic, if you like. So what is the next question? What is the question that you can ask back which might help you figure out where this person is coming from? Let's say actually you don't really know why they're asking this question. So what could you do, what could you ask to ascertain why they're asking this question? Any thoughts on that?
Ask about what sort of suffering they're thinking about.
Okay, yeah. That would open it out, wouldn't it, into different sorts of suffering and why different sorts of suffering might happen? Yeah?
Would you be able to ask, do you believe in God, and in God who is good?
Yeah, okay. So you could ask a question back about, you talk about God here. Yeah. What kind of God is this is it you're imagining? Yeah. You could simply say, I'm curious to know, what's behind this question for you?
Why do you think that's the key question?
So again, this kind of a little bit of pushback, which hopefully gets you engaged in some what I'm calling purposeful dialogue. And then, of course, there is the question, how might we then go about answering the question? Once we've ascertained what their motive is for asking, how then might we go about? Now, that's just a simple process that you might want to try with various questions that people might ask you. Why is this person asking this question? What can I do to work out to ask them another question back, and then how can I actually then respond to their question? You might want to try that with other different questions. As I say, there's lots of helpful stuff being written on this. I'm just giving the headlines. Let's say a little bit about defeating defeaters. Defeaters are those well-known stumbling blocks that people use to stop them seriously considering the claims of Christ. Suffering is, for instance, a classic defeater view. Or for other people, it's the presence of different religions in the world. How can you Christians say you've got the right way when the Buddhists and Muslims and Hindus and so on and so forth? I wish we had more time to look at this. If this is an area that interests you, Tim Keller's book, The Reason for God, is excellent on this, and I would really commend it to you. He looks in that book at some of the major defeaters that people sometimes bring against Christianity, and then responds to them in a very winsome and I think theologically faithful way. So do have a look at that. One of the things I think we need to remember here is that doubts are beliefs too. Often what we try to do when people ask us questions that are so-called defeaters is we try to answer them or we try to refute them when actually, again, we can push back a bit and try to deconstruct them, to show them, in other words, that what they think is a defeater is not quite as strong as they think it is. Now, again, I think this is a helpful tactic, and also to show, I think, that doubts about Christianity are really alternate beliefs about the world. We sometimes put people into believers camp and non-believers camp. That's the way actually many people in the world would see us. Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, Jews. We're believers and everyone else is non-believers. But of course, from a biblical perspective, we all exercise faith. There's either those who follow Christ or those who don't. And so even the statement of a defeater belief on the part of someone, if someone says, I just can't believe that there's one true religion, well, that's a statement of faith, do you see? Even if you say, I can't believe there's absolute truth, well, isn't that a statement for which you're claiming some level of truth? So again, there are ways of pushing back that may help expose some of these things for people. That you have faith, as I have faith. It's in different things, you see. Saying that we don't know is not admitting defeat. And you can always say, I'm not sure about that, but I'll give it some thought because I'd love to talk with you some more about that. And then you're allowing the conversation to continue at another point. Or, I'm sorry, I really don't know, but, there's this lovely man called Stuart who just loves answering questions like these. And, here's his mobile number and he's particularly on the ball at 3 o'clock in the morning. So do give him a call, But seriously, something that allows the conversation to continue. And that's why I've got that next heading there. Continuing conversation. Keep the conversation going. That's interesting you say that. Let me suggest an alternative. And you tell me if you think it's an improvement. Or if not, you tell me why you think your opinion is better. Keep the conversation going. And of course, however slowly, always crucial, isn't it, to steer a conversation towards Jesus. I wish we had more time to explore this in more detail, but try to get a conversation about a particular issue to something about Jesus, the reality of Jesus. Because there is power there. There is power there in the truth about who Jesus is and what Jesus has done. That really does speak to people, even if at the time you think it's not getting through. It might be. Okay. That's section two. I raced through a bit of that. Let me just, before we move on, does anyone want to make any comment, reflection, any particular question that's been raised in your mind as we've been talking? Not promise I'll answer it, but it's a good moment now if you want to voice it. Yeah.
First question you put on the screen, from the public. Why does a good God allow suffering?
Yes.
Found that when we do an open air, each mission, that sort of thing.
Yes.
Throw Satan into the mix. Because they often accuse God of why does God allow
yes.
it. But they give no credence to the Satan, the evil one,
yeah.
as to who's bringing lots of suffering into
yeah.
the world. And once
okay.
you bring that into the equation, God creates things good.
Yeah.
Satan twists, distorts things,
yeah.
and breaks things that the Lord creates as good.
Yeah. You found that helpful, have you, in open air situations? Okay, that's good. Yeah. And of course, that's part of the answer. It's part of it. I don't think it's the full answer myself, but it's certainly an aspect of why there's suffering in the world, isn't it? Because there's the evil one. Sin, exactly, yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And any other comment, reflection on what you've heard just now? Any comeback on anything? Rotten apples? Squashed tomatoes? I don't mind, I've got broad shoulders, I can take it.
Yeah. The question about suffering and God allowing it, in a sense, is drawing a line in the sand.
Okay.
What do they want God to allow?
Yes.
And what do they want God, or not allow God to
yeah.
allow?
Yeah.
They'll draw the line at a different point.
Yeah.
We don't want the catastrophes, but I want to be able to tell lies.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's an interesting aspect, isn't it? Of course, most recently, this has been in the news because of Stephen Fry, hasn't it? Some of you will have seen that interview that he gave where he was asked, you know, what would you say to God? And, you know, came out with some statement about why do you allow cancer to riddle children and blah, 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 and so on and so forth. Last comment for the moment.
Man owns this world and God is tolerated, it puts the Christian on the back foot.
Yeah.
But the earth is the Lord's, the fullness of So the Christian has every right to speak up for Jesus at
yeah.
any moment of the day.
Yeah.
Because the people who are not Christians are a guest on God's planet.
Yeah.
And when you've got that in your head,
yeah.
you don't apologise for Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
The last thing is, are you a bit about suffering? You saw what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
I mean, would you like him to turn up and do half a job, or would you like him to turn up and do a full job? And that puts you in a major predicament, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is it going to sort you out too?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good to come back. It's a good question to come back, isn't it? What would you like him to do? What would that look like for, you know, for you? And let me reaffirm what I tried to say at the start. Yeah, we are brothers. We're servants of the Lord of the universe. You know, we go into situations with the presence of the Lord with us. And that should empower us and encourage us no end. The earth really is the Lord's and everything in it. So thank you for that reminder. I did say one more, didn't I? But I'm going to break my rule and this is the last one.
I appreciate that. It's just in terms of your tactic, I think the why question is incredibly important
yeah.
for us all to remember.
Sure. Yeah.
It's that test of tolerance quite often that they're testing with us.
Yeah.
To just step back and really think about the question that they're asking.
Yeah.
Quite often it's about our tolerance. We just need to make sure we frame up questions.
Great. Well, thank you. That really helpfully reinforces what I've been trying to say today about listening attentively and engaging in dialogue that's purposeful. You know, as Peter talks about, with gracious and with respect and so on and so forth. So thank you for that. Yeah. Shall we move on, folks, and see how we do? You? Okay. Engaging confidently. We had listening carefully. And now engaging confidently. Let's come back to Athens for a while, and now you might like to, if you've got a Bible, you might like to open it to Acts 17. Again, we don't have the time to look at this in full. Millions of words have been spilt on Acts 17 with all sorts of different views, and I can't possibly do justice to the discussion. I've been very influenced and helped on this by a good friend of mine called Dan Strange, who I'll talk a little bit more about in a moment. But Dan, I think, has done some very helpful work on Paul's speech in Athens. And Dan reminds us that actually we start here with Paul's attitude being one of revulsion and provocation. Yeah. So Acts 17 verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them, this is Silas and Timothy, he's waiting in Athens. Kind of, he's killing time a bit in a sense. He's a bit of a tourist at this point. And he's waiting for Silas and Timothy. While he was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. Now, full of idols, literally submerged in idolatry. That's the sense. It's an unusual word. Paul is provoked as he looks at the scene in front of him. It's that negative reaction that then sets the mood for the whole encounter. And that means, I think, when we get down to verse 22, Paul then stood up, because if you know the story, he's eventually hauled. Maybe not hauled, it's not certain what's going on. But he's essentially giving a defence, if you like, to the council in Athens. And he begins, Paul then stood up, verse 22, in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious." And it's debated, is this stroking them, affirming them, so on and so forth. And then he goes on to talk about, "For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God." And certainly my friend Dan is persuaded that this is not a straightforward commendation. "Well done, Athenians, you're very religious." But actually a description of their ignorant speculation and searching. And so Paul then goes on to say in verse 23, "So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship, and this is what I am going to proclaim to you." So Paul's approach. What is Paul's approach? Well, this is where actually Paul has sometimes been criticised for what he does here, because he doesn't seem to mention Jesus. Or at least he doesn't mention Jesus until right at the very end. Now, maybe he was cut off, but it doesn't sound like the gospel in a sense. But arguably, I think this is the case. What Paul is doing here for the Athenians, he's providing a context. He's providing a bigger picture in which the good news of Jesus does make sense. And there is a sense in which what's going on in Acts 17 is not evangelism so much as pre-evangelism. So Paul needs this longer run-up, if you like, in which he gets in place some basic building blocks which the Athenians just don't have because of their pagan background. So Paul is essentially saying, let's go back to basics. You Athenians, you have all kinds of views about the nature of ultimate reality and creation and time and the end of all things. Let me lay out how I see it. The true God, this is what he's like. He's both transcendent but personal. He's both far and near. He's involved in his creation, but he's distinguished from that creation. He works through providence. There's a fall to recognize, and yet he's exercised patience. But one day there's going to be an end to history. Time is not cyclical, but linear. And one day there's going to be an end with a judgment coming. And he's proved that by raising Jesus from the dead. Now, is essentially, as I say, I think, setting in place some building blocks of a biblical worldview, in other words. Of a view which makes sense of the world from a biblical perspective, within which then Jesus can be placed for his pagan hearers. And it may well be that in biblically illiterate Britain, or maybe even in some of the contexts in which you find yourselves, we too, as I tried to say earlier, we too now often need to start much further back in our conversations with unbelievers. And maybe to spend more time in going through these worldview basics. Putting together a picture about what we understand about God, what we understand about creation, what we understand about what's wrong with the world. Because it's only when we've got those building blocks in place that we can then talk about Jesus and how Jesus makes sense of that, what he saves us from and what he saves us for. So I think Paul's approach in Athens is a particularly helpful model for us today as 21st century Westerners, as we engage with most of the people, at least, around us. And then there's Paul's appeal in verses 29 to 31. This is critical. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by human design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. That's his appeal. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. People have to repent of their sin and turn to Jesus in faith. They have to turn from idols, as the Thessalonians did, to serve the true and living God. And of course, in our engagement with people, that's what we're longing for, isn't it? That's what we'd like to get there, but we recognise we might need something of a run-up before we can talk to people about that. Now, we're going to circle back to Athens as we carry on. But I want us to look at a couple of strategies for confident engagement with others. Let me talk about four steps of engagement. And I put them there on the handout for you. Enter, explore, expose, evangelize. Now, this is where I would like to introduce you to my good friend Dan, who teaches at Oak Hill College in London. He teaches this stuff for a living. When I taught at London Bible College, London School of Theology, for 17 years, but my main area of expertise was in biblical hermeneutics, biblical interpretation, biblical theology. Dan is apologetics and contemporary culture and engaging, and so he's the man to really to go for this kind of stuff. In fact, I suggested to Trevor that you that he did this session, but anyway. But actually, you're going to get a little bit of Dan now. I've chatted with Dan about this, and he has what I'm calling four steps of engagement: enter, explore, expose, evangelize. Now, before we look at those, again, I have to have a bit of a run-up to this, and I hope you can stick with me if you're not flagging too much. Because Dan says, actually, he encourages, first of all, to understand culture through the lens of idolatry. He thinks this idolatry is a helpful diagnostic tool, really, for understanding popular culture, people's worldviews, and so on and so forth, showing the effects of sin on someone's heart, and particularly showing how, as human beings, we distort and redirect God's good gifts to us. Idolatry, you see, is always parasitic on the truth, on the good. It's Peter Day who taught me years ago that Satan's very unoriginal. He can only copy what God does. He can only distort what God does. And that's what idolatry does. Idols are parasitic. They're counterfeit. They feed off the truth. So the thing about idols is there's always a connection between the idol and the truth, do you see? There's always a connection there. And we can have to find ways of trying to get to that that connection. Because idols, essentially, if we had time, we could look at Old Testament references to this. Idols promise the same things that God promises. Prosperity, security, fertility, so on and so forth. And that's why they're so seductive. But what do they deliver? Destruction, despair, disillusionment, disappointment, death. They're futile. Idols promise, but they bring only destruction. Tim Keller mentioned a few times. He read a book a few years ago called Counterfeit Gods. When the empty promises of love, money and power let you down. So he looks there at money, sex and power and how they work in the culture around us and how they suck us in, even as Christians. And of course it's not that money, sex and power are bad in themselves, do you see? They're good things given by a good God. And yet what can happen subtly, slowly but surely, is that they take the place of God. God is the only true source of abundant life, but we think that we're going to find it elsewhere. And Tim Keller, along with others who've written in this area, make the helpful points that I mentioned earlier about the two kinds of idols, the surface idols, deep idols, or near idols and far idols, is the distinction that's sometimes used. So surface idols are the car you have, or the wife you'd like to have, or the hobby that you spend a lot of time on, or the great sex that you long for, or the little bit of more money that you think will make all the difference. Those are surface idols. And it could be something as seemingly trivial as keeping the lawn trimmed, or making sure the house is always clean, or the desire to get promoted at work, or being complimented by people in church on having such well-behaved kids. You see, many of those things, all of those things maybe, are good things, even right things, even things that you want to encourage in certain circumstances. But the problem is that we want them too much, or we want them for the wrong reasons, so that a good thing becomes an ultimate thing. And we invest ourselves in that rather than in God himself. Idolatry. So deep idols are what lie beneath the surface idols, what we hope the surface idols will give us. What we really want is security, significance, approval, comfort, control. So we pursue a surface idol because we think it will deliver on the deep idol. That's what will make us really happy. That's what we really worship. And again, idols feed off the truth. It's not that they're bad things in themselves, but they can't deliver what humans really need. They're powerless. A new car will not make us young again or incredibly attractive to the opposite sex. A first-class degree won't sort out our sense of self-worth. Putting a happy front on and pretending to people that we're great parents won't take away the sense of shame that we feel. And again, our problem is not necessarily that we do bad things. Our problem is that we turn good things into ultimate things. That's what idolatry is about. And we can see these good things being turned into ultimate things again and again in contemporary culture and again in our conversations with others. So what do we need to do? Well, we need, says Dan, to show that the gospel of Jesus is, are you ready for it? The subversive fulfillment of every culture. Now, I know that might sound complicated to our ears, but try to stay with it, because I think you'll find it useful. This is a term that Reformed theologian Hendrik Kramer used. Back in 1910, there was a famous missionary conference in Edinburgh. Some of you, if you know church history, may know about that. And people at the time were saying, you know, all these other religions in the world, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, and so on and so forth, they're like stepping stones to Jesus, of which Jesus is the fulfillment. And Kramer wanted to say, no, Jesus is the subversive fulfillment of those religions. Now, I'll explain in a moment what that means. But Dan thinks actually something like that is going on in Athens as well, with Paul and the Athenians. Why does Paul quote their own poets? Because he's doing subversive fulfillment. He's looking for a point of contact. This is not just a felt need of the sort which says, I'm affirming you in your religiosity. How wonderful for you. He's saying there's something going on with the way you're viewing the world. And the way it shows itself is that you've got this unknown God in your city. So in quoting their poets, he's not affirming their worldview. He's recognising actually they've seen something about the world, but it's truth suppressed. They know, but they don't know at the same time. And so what Paul does is a kind of subversive fulfillment procedure. What you don't know, I'm going to tell you. What you're longing for in this expression of worship, I'm going to show you its fulfillment. But he does it subversively. So the gospel fulfills the hopes of the culture and the hopes of people, but in a way that challenges the culture as well. It's subversive because it includes a challenge to repent of our idolatry and to believe the truth about the true and only God. But it's fulfillment because it offers the ultimate fulfillment of the underlying hopes and desires of us as people created in the image of God, as those whose hearts are restless until they rest in God himself. Now, in a sense, that's what Paul is doing in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. If you know that passage, when he writes about the cross, he talks about the cross being the power and the wisdom of God. Do you know that passage? He says the Jews want power and Greeks want wisdom. And here's the thing. The cross, he says, is true power and true wisdom, but not in the way that the Jews and the Greeks expected. So the gospel, the cross, both subverts power and wisdom, and yet at the same time fulfills power and wisdom. You want to see true power? You want to see true wisdom? Look at it in the cross. And you'll find the subversive fulfillment of the things that you're longing for. Now, we could say a lot more about this, but for Dan, this is a helpful way of understanding how we relate to culture, what's going on in cultural products that we, films that we watch, TV programs, books that we read, songs we listen to, whatever it might be. Because what we're doing is, when we're engaging with aspects of popular culture, or we're engaging with people in conversation, we can affirm some aspects of God's truth, but which may be found in an item of popular culture, there will be a grain of truth in there. But they'll be resisting other aspects of God's truth. So Dan speaks of these four steps. Enter. We enter into the worldview of other people. I suppose that in a sense this is what we've been talking about earlier about attentive listening. In other words, we listen. What's going on? We enter into this world. We discern the story. Understand what's going on in the movie or the song or whatever it might be. Understand where the person is coming from with their particular issue. And then we explore, says Dan. We search for elements of grace because God's creation is good. So there may well be elements of grace in what someone is saying or in this particular cultural product. But we also look for places where good desires have been misdirected. And then, says Dan, we expose. If we can, we show up those idols as destructive frauds. And we show that what people really want, whether it's justice or relationship or a sense of significance or a sense of identity, that that can't be delivered with those broken cisterns that they're trying to lick water from, as Jeremiah put it in Jeremiah chapter 2. Those things can't be delivered, but look, there's a fount of living water here, which gives you exactly what you need, but you're looking for it in the wrong place. And then we evangelize. We show off the gospel as the answer, as the subversive fulfillment of what it is that people are putting their hopes in. And it's subversive because it includes the challenge of turning away from that thing that you think will bring you fulfillment. It won't deliver on its promise, but it's fulfillment because what God has done in Jesus brings the true fulfillment of the underlying hopes and desires of men and women. Where do we do the stuff that we've been thinking about? Everyday life. Everyday life. Just need to reinforce that. I'm not talking here about gathered church activities, crucial though they are. I want to remind us we're sent out by Jesus into the different places we inhabit in everyday life. This is the context in which we engage with people on these issues. What is the content? Well, the content, of course, is the gospel. And I think, again, I do want to reinforce that at the end. Gospel is not a piece of good advice. It's not a set of good instructions. It is the good news of what God has done in Christ for the sake of the world. That's the content of our message. And confidence, again, to end there at the end of the day, for all our argument, for all our persuasion, for all our subversive fulfillment, even if we never remember that phrase ever again, no one becomes a Christian unless the Spirit of God reanimates dead hearts. And yes, the Spirit does choose to work through means, through tactics, through questions, through attentive listening, through careful engagement. Yes, the Spirit is pleased to use us, and it's an incredible privilege to be involved, isn't it, in what God is doing. But He blows where He wills. And that, at the end of the day, is, I think, where our confidence finally lies. God will be pleased to work through us, but He alone will get the glory. And in Him alone, our true confidence lies. Amen.
Amen.
Folks, I know Trevor's just about to stand up. Thank you. I'm sorry we didn't get through all the material. But I hope at least something has been helpful for you as you go forward. And I just want to say thank you for being such a very kind, gracious and engaging bunch of people to be with this morning. Thank you.